to Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome you to 269th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 268 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, and it's free. And once again, that's at www.johnmack13.com. Writers in the Hudson Valley should be aware that every Thursday evening is the weekly meeting of the Mahopac Writers Guild group, now in its 21st year at 6:30 p.m. in the Mahopac Library on Route 6 in Mahopac. More than 150 books have been published by writers from this group. Additionally, the Yorktown Poetry Workshop, composed of fledgling and experienced poets, will hold its monthly meeting at 6 o'clock on March 27th at the John C. Hart Library in Cherbourg, New York. If you wish to read, and if you then you do not have to, please bring a copy of your book. Finally, April is National Poetry Month, and there will be poetry readings sponsored by both the Mahopac Poetry Workshop and the Yorktown Poetry Workshop the week of April the 7th. More on these events in subsequent weeks. Anyone wishing information on any of these meetings may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. I hope you'll be right back here at the same 7 p.m. Eastern Time next Sunday for my interview with photographer and steampunk author Rene Fleury. Now to this week's show. As mentioned, the 269th in the series, it is fitting that my guest on St. Patrick's Day, Karen McCadden, is both an Irish and a U.S. citizen. It is, however, something of a coincidence that the real reason she is here is that she's an accomplished and published poet as well as a high school English teacher. The listeners wishing to call in to join Karen to me on the air may do so by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. 716-9756. I've generally called participation and until near the end of my conversation with my guest. I have not met Karen in person, but as with many literary connections, we are Facebook friends and have had discussions on our respective work. So let's get started. Welcome to the show, Karen.
Thanks so much, John. Thanks for having me.
Would you start us off with the poem?
Sure. In honor of St. Patrick's Day, this one is called Caletter Forest, Father McLaughlin's Well. We cut through the forest to check the sheep on the far mountain and stop to fill our bottles. Sitka spruce make a grid filled with moss. Above the holy water on a shelf of this shrine, baby toys, wrappers of pills, prayer cards, Star Wars posters, Jesus, his beard chipped, pointing to his flaming heart. Next to him, another Jesus, broken ankles, alabaster, hollow and full of leaves, a hole clear through his chest, baby dolls, a cane, and face down there, another Jesus slumped beside the shotgun shells, packs of cigarettes, snow globes. Near inhalers and Hello Kitty and zipped baggies of jewelry and charms, another Jesus, hands open. We kneel to bless ourselves. Midges worry the air until they find us. Nearby, in the asphodel, in the wet ditch, horse bones almost clean look like what I think I am underneath.
Wow, Dave, that was powerful. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sure.
Where exactly did you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in Lexington, Massachusetts, and I went to school, public schools there all the way through high school, graduated from Lexington High School.
Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
Probably to own a horse when I was a little girl. But in high school, I really wanted to be a poet. It's really funny that I get to be one now, but it's what I wanted to be, even though people would say it was kind of impractical. But here I am.
Were you an early reader?
Yes, very much so.
Did you write for a school paper in high school or for the literary journal?
No, we didn't have either of those things, or if we did, I didn't know about them. I wrote for myself. I had my own little, notebooks and secret little projects.
So how about another poem then?
How about what? Another poem?
Yes, sure. Please.
Let's see. This one's called The Mother Talks to Her Son About Her Heart. So what? So what that you grew inside of someone else? It doesn't mean you aren't in here now. In here, right here. Oh, my heart. What's in here is not my own anymore, anyway. There is Teflon and stitching. Other people's hands have been in here. By this, I mean to tell you there is room. There is a house in here I had hoped to fill. I saved clothes forever, waiting for more babies. So I wanted you. I always wanted you. A heart has four rooms. You are one son. There is room. When I was young and wanting to bring you home, they found a hole in my heart and patched it. I grow older and the outside door fails, and so I get a new one. In the lumber yard of the heart, the materials are strange. Teflon, like I said, for the hole, and a valve from a cow to seal the doorway. Over and over, I shore this place up. Steady, old girl, I say to my heart, and I call in its ticks to the doctor. I love her like I love you, like I have always loved you. She calls me back and reads my stats. I call your sister and tell her the score, that I am always winning another day. Steady, steady, takes the pacemaker. I keep a good house. You know that. These days, I keep my heart like a summer cottage. The light is bright and warm. I won't speak of anything else. You forget. You forget all the time. You are supposed to come home. You are supposed to know these things. You are supposed to know which door to knock on, that I will open it.
Wow. And what happened after high school?
What happened after high school? I went to college. I went to college at St. Michael's College and majored in English. And soon thereafter, I also studied radio journalism. And then I went to, I became a teacher. I went to Goddard College and was certified to become a teacher and became a teacher.
And at some point, you also did an MFA. Was that directly after it, or was that
a good deal later? That was a good deal later. I did that 2012 to 2014, so that was really pretty recent, just 4 years.
Okay. So you began teaching right away. Now, I know that you did not publish for a number of years due to your teaching and raising a family, but were you writing all the time?
Oh, yes, definitely. I was writing. I've always been writing. So that was – I did one of those foolish things where I started trying to publish right away and I didn't really know what I was doing and got dispirited, so I stopped. So I just wrote privately for a long time. Yeah.
So would you trace your teaching career for us, when and where and how, if at all, and does it tie into your writing?
Oh, sure. So when and where? I started teaching in 1992, so I've been teaching for 27 years at Montpelier High School, ironically or unironically, in the same classroom this whole time, so I'm in room 102, still and always, and what else did you ask me? Why?
And where, and does it tie in at all to your writing?
Oh, sure.
To teaching.
At Montpelier High School in Montpelier, Vermont. It's a small high school. We have anywhere from 350 to 400 students in total. So we're in the state capital. And I'd say that the way it ties into my teaching is they let me teach creative writing. So I write often with my students, and I get to talk about creative writing all the time, and I teach a whole semester of poetry writing every year, and my students work on all aspects of the craft of creative writing with me.
Speaking of writing, how about one more poem before we get into your poetry history?
Sure. Let's see. Here, I'll read you this one. This is called Husband. I walk around saying husband, though I have none. Some years I grow perennial husbands and some wild husbands in clumps along the creek. I live in husband territory, in the migratory path of husbands. I think I heard an H of husbands flying north overhead. My God, look at the size of that husband at the feeder. What a wretched day. The husbands just won't stop falling. I bring the car to the garage and shake my head. I think there is something wrong with the husband, I say, pointing under the hood. I tap at my watch face to unstick the husband. Who put the damned husband up on that shelf? How I love a good husband. The bedclothes are as cold as a husband. What, though, is a ride down the lazy river without a husband? Hold my hand like you're my husband, I say, on dates. Dates and dates with husbands. Oh, husband, I sigh on bar stools and at tables. I spend all morning solving for husbands, writing proofs. Oh, you wicked, wicked husband, come here.
I suspect that that's from your first book, is it?
No, so everything I've read to you so far is from my second manuscript, and that poem is I wrote it while I was with my husband. I have a second husband. I wrote it when I was quite happy, but I was imagining the search for the husband. So, and it's definitely written in a tongue-in-cheek kind of way, but it's got some definite darkness in it, too.
What kicked you after you said you were discouraged because you really didn't know much about publishing, and then what got you to restart? Because once you did, your first book won two prizes that we'll talk about in a minute. What
sure.
What got you in into the publishing routine finally?
Well, this would be another way that my students and my high school teaching have played into my life as a writer. I was one year I was teaching a genealogy research course, and I promise this is going to answer your question. I didn't have enough students to run it, and I said to my principal, "Give me a creative writing course, and I'll get enough students, and within 2 weeks I'll be able to teach this course." And he said, "Okay." So I would push my students in the beginning to send their work out and do public readings and things like that. And one day they looked at me and they said, "What are you doing? What about you? What about you doing something with your writing?" And they sort of held me to task, and so I started sending work out to sort of be more honest as a teacher.
Once you started the publish, you got very good critical reviews. Your first book, Landscapes, Reply with Silhouettes, won both the 2013 New Wishes Poetry Prize and the 2015 Vermont Book Award. Would you tell us about both the awards and the book itself?
Sure. The awards, the first one, the New Issues Poetry Prize, is a prize that the New Issues Poetry and Prose Press, that's a mouthful, they use to publish first books. So it's you win the prize and then they publish your book. So that's how often a first book gets published in poetry, is it wins a prize like this at a press. So so that's that one. And it was judged by David St. John, who's a chancellor at the Academy of American Poets now and a lovely, lovely person that I have really enjoyed knowing since that prize, since I won that prize. I don't know him, I don't know him physically in person, but we correspond relatively regularly. And the book is about the dissolution of a marriage and how to find a life afterward. So it digs into the darkness of loneliness and, you know, raising children by yourself and what happens in those spaces and in the middle of your life, how you can find yourself again. So while it's a book about divorce and it digs pretty hard into that, it definitely, as a book, arrives on the other side with joy and possibility and reconciliation. So
it also won a 2015 Vermont Book Award. What is that?
Yes. So Vermont College of Fine Arts in Montpelier, Vermont, started this book award the year that I won it. It was the first year of the prize. And they collect all the books that were written in Vermont or about Vermont or by Vermont writers for that year. And then they winnow them down to a selection of finalists. And they have a judging body, and they pick the winner every year. And they throw young adult literature and fiction and creative nonfiction and poetry all in together. And may the best book win. So, you know, it's a strange kind of competition across genres as well. But so it won the first one, and it was pretty exciting.
Now, after growing up in Massachusetts, as you mentioned, you've had most of your adult life in Vermont. Was that an accident because that was the teaching job that you got, or did you focus on Vermont and then go looking for opportunities in the state?
Well, I when I was a kid in Massachusetts, I wanted to be somewhere rural. I wanted to be somewhere where there were horses and farms and fields and less people, fewer people. So I went to college at St. Michael's College, which is in Vermont, and just stayed, I think much to my mother's chagrin. But I really love it up here. So I just stayed because I loved it, and then things happened from there.
I mentioned to you that I have some friends, four women, who have all been on the show, who have who one of them has the place in Vermont, and every year they go up for a week together to work on their writing. I believe I've one of them on the line now. Who's dialing from the 725 exchange?
I'm on, John.
Was it Ann?
John, it's Ann.
Okay. Tell Karen where you live and what you do during the summer with the group.
Okay. First of all, happy St. Patrick's Day to you both.
Thank you. And to you.
And I have a home in Chester, Vermont, and that is the place we've been going to for more than 20 years. The poet Linda Simone, the poet Terry Dugan, and the memoirist Sarah Bracy White. And the four of us go up there for, you could call it an extended weekend. And we just bring our work, we give each other feedback, we talk about what we want to do. And, you know, sometimes it's painful because we're brutally honest with each other, like, no, that's not going to work.
Right.
What you have in mind to do. And then, you know, we really cheer each other on and then share ideas around, you know, marketing and promotion. And it's really, you know, like any group of women who love each other, who know each other very well and get together on a yearly basis or semi-annual or whatever, you know, we just, it's like taking a bath. It's just very nurturing. And
that's a great image.
No, it is. It's our spot, time together. And it's gotten to the point while all the husbands were a little ornery at first that we should do this. Now they're like, please, no, you have to go. You have to go. There's
That's
no
great.
Way you have to do this. To the point that Linda Simone, who moved to San Antonio, you know, will buy a ticket months ahead to make sure she can make it. So anyway, so that's my story.
That's wonderful. I think that's the best way to grow as writers, is to be in community with other people who are doing the same work.
Absolutely. And John is that. John is like the Pied Piper of Upper Westchester County. My friend Terry Dugan has really flourished by entering the community that he's created. But you know what? This interview isn't about us. It's about you. So... Karen, I wanted to... John, is it okay if I ask Karen a question?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay, great. So, Karen, I really have enjoyed what I've heard and what I've read online of your work. It's very layered, and you take, ordinary relationships and emotions, and you pitch them in a new way so that... your poems are really engaging and they go in surprising places. But what I wanted to ask you was, in your growing up as a poet, was there any one or two or three poets that helped you get in sync with your own voice?
Oh, that's a great question. Thank you. Yes, and it's a strange answer. I was a big student of French when I was younger. I was fluent in French when I graduated from high school, and so I really enjoyed reading poetry in French, I think partially because it allowed me to reach into the poem in a different way, to sort of know and not know the nuances of the language.
Right.
But then there's a French poet named Paul Éluard. He was one of the symbolist poets.
Yes.
And I loved his work. I just had this little book, and I read it and read it, and I would transcribe it, and I would translate it, and I loved. And what I loved about it was I didn't know always what he was saying, but I loved how he was saying it. It was very, and so my earlier poems were so much more strange than they are now. I don't think anybody could have made sense of them at all. But it's really where I learned that love of the absurd and the strange image and the reaching into something unexpected. And I appreciate your question too.
So you're in your heart, you're still doing that.
I think, you know, I've always had an imagination that surprises me, you know, so I just enjoy this art as a place where I can exercise that. You know, so much of what we do in school is write essays when we're kids and write these really logical documents. And I always had a hard time with them. You know, my teachers would always tell me, you know, to work on my organization or my outlining, which this is a natural way of thinking, was not quite so orderly. And I really love that space of a poem where you can go wherever you like.
So,
you know?
So sometimes I feel like being a poet is a way. It's like a second. It's a first language. Do you feel that way too?
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I also think like when I was a kid, I went to church a lot. We're Catholic, and. The language of the Mass was the only high language I had ever heard. It was the only really formal language I knew. So I think that was also a part of it being that, I don't know how to say this, in a way that formal language was one of my first languages. I heard it regularly. So that's not quite what you're asking, but it reminds me to say that, you know.
Was it in Latin?
Having different registers of language. No. No, but it was just really formal, you know, the Eucharistic prayer and all the language was, and then there's all this call and response and rhythmic sound.
And also, so, you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but also don't you think there was some mystery?
No, go for it.
Mystery?
Oh, totally. And metaphor. You know, I think that the scripture and the litany are all rich with metaphor and mystery and leaps. You know, there's all kinds of leaps of logic and faith in any, well, I don't want to go that far, but, you know, it's in the
Judeo-Christian tradition.
That, yes, thank you. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
Karen,
digging into religion on the phone, but.
Anne writes a monthly newsletter called The Anagram, which is terrific, and I will send it to you. In addition to all everything that's going on and opportunities and things in the area, she also, of all things, has recipes right in the middle of them. So,
that is
poetical.
Great.
So I'll send you the way to get onto that.
Listen, I don't think someone from Vermont needs a good soup recipe, John.
That's true. But I'll take it.
All right.
You both mentioned the working with other people. I belong to two regularly scheduled poetry workshops. I coordinate one as well as another writers group. And Reeve Dezan does at various open mics in the area. Do you know, Tamik, I mentioned that you're in the group with a number of other poets, but it seemed to me that your group is a little less formally structured than mine and that involves meals and everything. Could you tell us about yours, Karen?
It's kind of hyper formally structured when we're in the space of working together, but you know how often we meet is like right now we're in kind of a lag time. We met recently. There were four of us who came, so it's sort of flexible in terms of who comes. There's a cadre of about 12 poets. We've been meeting I've been a part of the group for I think 7 years now, and so when we sit together, we have a very highly structured way that we talk about the work. We set a timer. We have little rituals that involve like who gets to speak and who doesn't. It's kind of a classic workshop environment. So Anne mentioned, or you mentioned, brutal honesty. Anne did, and we definitely work on that as well.
You mentioned earlier that you did the MFA a good deal later. Was that before you started to publish or after?
I was after. I'm 53, and when I was turning 40, I decided I wanted to publish one poem by the time I turned 40. So I started publishing when I was 40. And then I did my MFA after I wrote my book. So I wrote the book. It got taken while I was in the MFA program. And So I spent my 40s really working on getting work published and writing really hard.
Now, your poetry
also
appears in a number of, mm-hmm. of fine journals, as well as the annual Best American Poetry. Would you tell us about some of the poems selected for Best American Poetry and some of the other publications to which you've appeared?
Sure. I had a poem that was in, it's called Becca, and it was in American Poetry Review, and Mark Doty picked it for Best American Poetry in 2012. And he subsequently picked one of my poems for the Poem a Day series at the Academy of American Poets, which was an enormous thrill. One of those publications where, you know, it goes out, your poem goes out in an email to 60,000 people in the morning. You know, it's like got a lot of responses, and it was really a wonderful feeling to feel so many people reading my work. I have, but are you asking me which journals have taken my work?
Yes.
I've had work in American Poetry Review, like I said, and Beloit Poetry Journal, Rattle. I have a poem coming out in next winter in Plowshares, Prairie Schooner, The Collagist. I don't want to forget. I'm going to forget people. The horse. I love the journal Horse Thief. If anyone hasn't seen Horse Thief, it's a wonderful, really tactile online journal. There's more. I'm not thinking of them right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And speaking of poetry, how about another poem?
Sure. Can I read one that's not really happy? I mean, not that. Yeah, of course I can. Right?
Sure.
This is so. I think I'll say something about this one. My husband is runs an airport up in the near the Canadian border. And this is a long poem about that and that space and also living in the north, living in the far north, like where we are. It's called At Franklin County Airport. No air traffic control. The radio buzzes call signs. You tie down your plane and come sit at the table where I learn about near misses from you. Even when I tell you I have to work, you tell me the next story, or nod across the table saying, Frank, it's true, right? You remember. You bite into your sandwiches like heroes. I think of the swans up the road scrabbling inside their wrought iron fence as if this town were the center of anything, as if a case could be made by anything here for swans, for a town hall replica for them to shade inside. Swans at the center of this place where people fall off the edge of the earth, walk away from their homes and never come back. Some of us up north have no idea where we come from, no idea what might come. Once here, we risk losing ourselves, losing children in the school with no windows. At dusk, here in the airport, I watch the sun go down and wonder what it's like underneath the flat earth spreading away from me. The roots of all of us dangle in the dark, shrink back from the sun while we sleep, our bad dreams pulled back inside the darkness, our children running amok to find their edges. I wonder what the swans have to do with anything, why I always think about them fenced inside the green, inside the rotary, cars driving circles around them, their beaks sifting water and mud, everything they do making circles. Their beaks hammering the earth soft, their feet packing it down. Night comes and I watch the trees fade. I remember the time you pointed out the satellite, your arm a pointer I couldn't follow. Yes, I said, I see it, though I didn't. And now, waiting for you to finish work, the snow comes down like a single bed sheet over the north. I hold the swans out like a question I can't answer. I don't know what they mean any more than I know how to lift one of these small planes off the ground, but I know the growl of their engines, that standing behind one, its prop wash will knock me over. Years ago, a woman ran out to her husband's plane to ask him for something, and the propeller, still running, invisible as insects' wings, cut her down as fast as we swat flies. Some god must have felt like we feel then, taking aim. I wait for you to lock all the doors, and check the tie downs out past where she died, out past where you turned the door into a wall no one could ever walk out of again. You check and check every undone thing. The chair I love best faces the old door's frame, just under the sheetrock, proof of nothing, of where we go.
Wow. Well, now, how far is the border and the airport from where you live in Montpelier?
Oh, I live in South Burlington, actually.
Okay.
And so I live about 45 minutes north of Montpelier, and then the airport and the border are about 40 minutes north of here.
Oh, so you're about in the middle. Okay. And how did you happen to choose Vermont to have a home?
My husband is an amateur astronomer, and there's a big kind of Woodstock of amateur astronomer telescope makers every summer in Springfield called Stellafane. And it's quite old, and people from all over the world come, and they pitch tents, and it's just a great experience. So we used to go up there for a few summers and camp, and we were actually looking for a home in New England, and I have relatives in New Hampshire, and that was just too far away to think of a second home or a summer home. So we just, because of Stellafane, we hooked up with a real estate agent and started looking around, and then found our dream house, and it's just been so incredible. I was thinking about Karen saying that, you know, when she was young, she wanted to be in a more rural setting, and I know coming to Vermont, it really impacted my poetry. My first chapbook is called Sugaring, and it's really based on all these poems that came out of me just from being in Vermont. And just having been there, John, I can say that what Karen just read about that airport in Franklin County is so authentic and accurate to the loneliness and the what is the word I'm looking for? There's kind of the spareness of the winter and the cold and the I don't know. Karen, you just nailed it with that poem. It was it was incredible. I just felt myself there. I think for me as a poet, and maybe for Karen too, you know, environment has a big impact on what we, on our output.
Well, and it's true that poets, we're obligated to use, and all writers, imagery, right? And there's no shortage of things to see in Vermont. There's no shortage of images that aren't normal in our more urban settings, like this more, especially in like a kind of downtrodden area like Franklin County is. There's a lot to see that you can pull into a poem that creates atmosphere.
Yes, yes. In fact, you know what? I wrote a poem myself about a couple getting married at Springfield Airport.
Oh, that phrase is great.
So, I mean, that's the kind of thing
I was thinking,
you see in Vermont.
And my husband and I were talking about how great it would be to have, because, you know, getting people interested in aviation these days isn't that easy. You know, it's an older person's hobby. And he's, you know, he's relatively young and wants to see young people involved. And he said we should get, each airport should have a poet in residence where you could just go write, because there aren't that many people at these little airports. So you could just go have a little residency.
This airport that my husband and I visit regularly, like a shrine, because we love it so much. It's called Harkness in Springfield, and it was built essentially just to welcome Charles Lindbergh, who was coming back from his world tour.
That's great. That's great history. Yeah.
So yes,
the airport in Vermont.
Please tell your
airport.
Husband I vote for the poet in residence program. I think that's
right?
Great.
I think it would be great fun.
Yeah.
Every poet needs a studio, you know.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
My
I'm
wife
picking
was
up my lunchbox. I'm going to the airport. I'll see you at 5.
Right, exactly.
My wife Barbara was a private pilot for years, and she and on a solo flight, she got lost. Her radio went out, and she landed on the farmer's field in Versailles, Indiana. And she landed the wrong way on the farmer's field. No one told her that you should go with the plows, not bouncing across them. And she, the reason that she picked it was there was a building that said motel on a roof, and it was getting late. So the state police came, and they the next morning they cleared the highway because she could take off from the highway. And she was very lucky because there are very few states in the union that won't let you that will let you take off again. You normally have to tow your plane away. So that was was her story. That was long before us. So, Karen, on a completely different subject, I mentioned at the beginning of the show that you, like my son, by the way, have both Irish and American citizenship, but you did not grow up close to Ireland, and you only developed them in your 40s. Tell us about that, and what was the impetus to reach out to your roots?
It's a perfect topic for today, isn't it? As a kid, I was always kind of a stubborn kid, and my grandparents were both, my father's parents were both from Donegal. They came over here independently of each other. They lived about a mile and a half from each other and knew each other growing up, and then came over separately, saw each other at a dance, fell in love, and got married outside of Boston, which was kind of lovely. So I was raised going to visit them on weekends and family dinners, and they have these beautiful accents. So I was always well aware of the fact that they were from Ireland. But they wouldn't really talk about it. And they would sometimes fight, you know, not fight, but if they ever had an argument, they would resolve it by my grandmother saying, well, at least we didn't have a dirt floor. So they both grew up with quite a bit of poverty and lots of people in small houses, but also lots of joy. But they came here and they wanted, I think they wanted us to just become Americans. You know, they gave everything away to come here, and they wanted us to sort of let go of that and just keep our feet in this country. And she would never answer my questions about Ireland. She'd say, wished your brother, wished, when I'd ask her. And so she died when I was 19, and my grandfather died when I was, I think, 12 or 14, and I just never knew, and we had no ties to Ireland at all. But then the internet happened, and I have an unusual last name, and all of us with my last name are, so far, we're all related. There's not a McCadden that we can't trace to Donegal or somewhere. Excuse me. So I Googled my last name back in the dawn of the internet and met a cousin. Because, of course, you can't Google a McCadden without them being your cousin. And he put me in touch with one of my cousins named Mike Mulligan. And we both were genealogy buffs. And he came over here to visit me with his sister when they were young. And so we became close friends as well as cousins. And then his sister got married and invited us over to the wedding. And that was the first time I went over. And my grandfather's farm is still farmed by my cousin, a different cousin. He's my father's first cousin, Pat McCadden. And so I started going to visit Pat. I went to the wedding and I visited Pat, and I just really loved him. And so I try to go back every summer, every other summer. And now when I go back, I stay at his house and get to stay on the farm. And the cousins come visit from, you know, all over. I've got a bunch of cousins my age, my generation. So it's become a huge important part of my life. Yeah.
I could go on,
but that's the story. Huh?
I could have dual citizenship because all my four grandparents that were born there, but I don't have any records. They were from the north, from Derry. I know when two of them came over, but I don't have the information that I would need for the embassy to get where they were from and where they, what churches they were baptized in or whatever. But growing up in an Irish Catholic Jewish neighborhood where both the Irish Catholics thought they owned the neighborhood and the Jews thought they did because they didn't hang around together, so it was all neighborhoods. And that I had no interest in the Irish because of them killing each other in the north that I was not happy with. I didn't understand it very well. And also because I came from a strong beer-drinking neighborhood, and St. Patrick's Day seemed to me to be an embarrassment where people use it as an excuse to get drunk.
Oh, agreed, yeah.
But it was only in reading the literature, particularly in reading novels by Andrew Greeley, who had such a terrific voice for the language, you know, and then obviously getting into the literature. Greeley had one thing about this this fellow who was a bond trader who was touring Africa, and he had this woman, and she kept calling him something. It was this long word, and I kept saying, "What the hell is that word?" And then I slowly read it. She was calling him the Rich Folk and Yank, you know, and I picked up to what you're saying, you know, and then I picked it up.
That's funny.
So I am interested in it, but it's only from later life. So the,
yeah, can I ask something about in response to what you said?
Sure.
It's okay if I say something. Yeah. So what you said is actually how I found my way to really caring about it and really reaching out, was because I didn't know anything about the politics growing up. I sort of vaguely knew about the IRA. I didn't know what it meant. And I sort of just, I guess I was ignorant about it. I spent a year reading only books by Irish writers about Ireland because I was like, I should learn. You know, I was a young adult. So I should learn about this place that my family comes from. And that was what, learning about the history made me understand how beautiful and sad the story is. I love a good tragedy. And I love the hard scrabble. I've always loved the underdog and hard scrabble stories. So it, really the books I read were a big part of how I fell in love with Ireland and really committed to finding out about it.
I know you're working on a second book. Are you comfortable telling us about it?
Yeah, I am. It's currently, I've got it taped up on all the walls in my house. I've been trying to get it together in order. So it's down my bedroom hallway and across my closet door and down the other hallway and up the hallway. It's all over the house. And it's about three different things. So its focus is on the ruined home, which doesn't sound like a happy thing, but poems often aren't. It's about, you know, how homes fall apart. So it's got some poems still about divorce and the disintegration of an original family through divorce. It's got poems about Ireland and going back and the ruins and the landscape there, and some family poems too, not too many. It's mostly focused on sort of ghosts in the landscape and imagined spaces and the plants. And I have some poems from going to Station Island and Loch Derg, which is a retreat space. And then I've got a thread of poems. I have I had a brother. He passed away this past year of an overdose. And so my young adulthood, my brother struggled with addiction. He was a heroin user and made it to 49 years old, but he overdosed. So there's a bunch of poems processing that sort of ruination that can visit a family through addiction as well. I'm not quite convinced that all the poems really go together, but I'm trying to work on imagining that they do.
Do you have a timetable for
it? I'm calling it the Big Dig. I'm hoping to send it out and try to find a press for it later this spring. The poems are definitely written. I just have to decide on how I like the order of them and sections and things like that. But
what else?
It's a good time. It's 5 years since my last book, almost.
What else is next for you?
With writing? Is that what you mean?
in writing or in writing anything in prose about Ireland or in travel or in
I probably will go back to Ireland this summer. I really hope to. It's been the past couple of years I've moved and got married, and so it's been a lot of life events that have kept me from traveling. So I hope to go back this summer. And I've already started working on a third book, and I've committed to having it be more comical, more sort of maybe philosophical, less focused on tragedy, and more focused on just, I've got a sequence of poems about Evel Knievel, love poems to Evel Knievel. I've got a bunch of more quirky poems, and I'm hoping to build a book of them. And I have an essay I want to write on the prepositional phrase. I love prepositional phrases in poems, so I might write a little scholarly essay on that.
When I got into motorcycling and into motor scootering, my son had, and I had before him, Evel Knievel toys all over the place, just because it had to do with riding. I remember when he tried to jump the canyon, and that didn't work out for him. So. Anne, do you have anything else for Karen before we start?
I just want to give Karen some feedback that I think the book sounds like it's perfect.
Well, thank you.
The three subjects, home, Ireland, and the personal loss, it's all family. And it's all that journey to reconcile it all. And it's joyful, and it's painful, and it's beautiful, especially if you go to a place like Ireland. So I am very excited to read it.
Well, thank you. I better get to work then.
I think so.
Okay. I've got my marching orders.
Yes. A lot of pressure from New York.
Thanks for that.
We've covered a lot of bases in exploring your life. What else would you like the audience to know about Karen McCadden?
Oh, I don't know. Boy, I don't know. That's a lot. I said a lot. Despite my poems often being kind of sad, I have a great sense of humor. I really can't think of anything. Help me out, John. What should I tell you?
Well, you've already talked about to what you've written, to your teaching, to your education, to your trips to Ireland, to your marriages, to the airport. So it seems that we've touched a whole lot.
We're close. Well, I can tell you a little bit about my lovely children.
Okay. Why don't you?
I can't mention my family without saying something about them, because they definitely inspire me a lot. My son is an avid basketball player. I spend more time in gymnasiums than I ever thought I would. Just, you know, and really falling in love with the game. And my daughter lives nearby. She studied neuroscience at University of Vermont, and it's a thrill to get to live near her when she's in her mid-20s. And my stepson is down in Mississippi serving with AmeriCorps in the NCCC FEMA Corps. I'm very proud of them all. So I should give them a little shout out here.
Well, I can talk about basketball. One of my poems is I was a basketball whore, because I played all over the place, and I have a really screwed up the right ankle, and I have arthritic knees and arthritic hips, and as I say in the end, it was all worth it.
I love to watch it. It's a beautiful game. I love watching young men fall and being respectful.
If you have the passion for anything, the pain's worth it, and we can come right back to your poems about joy and pain, and in many ways they all go together.
Yeah, it's true. It's very true.
How about taking us off with another poem?
All right. I'll read you a poem. It's called How to Miss a Man, and it's from my book.
Okay.
How to Miss a Man. Breathing is just a rhythm. Tell yourself this so that the breathing becomes a song. Sing this song all day while you shop in the hardware store for things you do not need. Sing it again while you cook supper for yourself. Cook supper for yourself even if you don't want to. Go for a walk even if you don't want to. Put your shoes on and get the leash and even bring the dog. She will be so pleased you might start to forget. Also, breathe. It is a rhythm. Walk around the block and even farther if you have a mind to. You might. Your feet will take you. They can. If you listen, they are a rhythm also, like drums, hand drums. Swing your hands while you walk. Tell yourself they are kind of like wings, that the bird's wing has a hand inside it. It does. Come home and make tea. Every time you dip the tea bag, hold your breath like you are underwater. Hold, breathe, hold, breathe, like that. Like you are swimming across Lake Pleiades, underwater like a fish, above water like a bird, until you are stitching lake and sky. You are a needle just then, darning holes in things, a weave of stitches across and down, like a graph. You need to be a graph, a grid. Numbers are perfect. You can draw two lines on a graph that can never touch. This is what you are building.
That's a very good wrap too. This is what you're building, hopefully. Thank you very much,
mm-hmm.
Karen. It's been a real and thank you very much for joining in.
Oh, my pleasure. I love Karen's work, and I'm a little bit in awe here.
Well, let's get in touch then.
That sounds
good. I really appreciate John. I appreciate you having me. This has been such a great conversation. Thank you so much for having me on your show. And thank you, Anne, for popping up and asking such great questions.
Oh, you're welcome.
And thank you both again. Send any comments or questions to me about the show to johnknock13@gmail.com, and be sure to join us next week at the same time for my conversation with Renee Flory. Go to my website, www.johnknock13.com, for URLs of previous shows and recordings of all the shows. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in the book. And until next time, as Lisa Sandy Old Neighborhood, see ya. But let's go off with the Eagles. Amazon, play Peaceful Easy Feeling.
Peaceful Easy Feeling from your library, starting now on Amazon Music.
Thanks again, Karen, and good night.
Thank you so much.
Keep me standing.